Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic for the hour tonight is combating food waste in the Bay Area. It may not be our foremost thought in our minds as we scrape our unfinished meals and wilted kale into the compost bin, but the figures are stark. According to the US EPA, Americans throw away an average of 34 million tons of food every year, only a tiny percentage of which is recovered or recycled. By many estimates, this means that more than 40% of edible food in the U.S. goes to waste, a figure all the more troubling, advocates point out, in the light of the environmental and economic costs of producing, distributing, and disposing of all this unwanted food, and the number of needy Americans whom it could feed. What policies, practices, and cultural norms lead us to squander so much food? What can we do, from farm to fork, to reduce how much waste we do with food? And how can we put surplus food to good use? This hour, we'll explore these questions and more with a special emphasis on what Bay Area organizations and individuals are doing to raise awareness, reduce waste, and direct discarded food to those in need. Joining me tonight to discuss these questions and more are Dana Gunders. She's project scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, where she focuses on food and agricultural issues. Welcome, Dana. And we're also joined by Sue Sigler. She is executive director of the California Association of Food Banks, a nonprofit organization dedicated to creating a well-nourished California through such initiatives as the Family to Farm program. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Aaron French. He's an East Bay-based chef, food blogger, and author, most recently of the book Bay Area Homegrown Cookbook. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks a lot.
And a little later in the program, we'll be joined by phone by Elizabeth Boileau, a San Francisco-based food activist and one of the founding board members of Food Runners, a volunteer organization dedicated to alleviating hunger and preventing food waste. And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation in about 20 minutes or so by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. So I wanted to start with you, Dana Gunders. How much edible food is wasted in the U.S. annually?
About 40% of the food in the U.S. actually goes uneaten.
Can you actually give us a sense of what that really means?
I mean, it's a vast amount. It's been estimated as enough food to fill the a football stadium every single day. And, you know, as individuals, it's costing us quite a bit of money. And so the estimate is that the average family of four spends somewhere between $130 and $175 every month on food that they throw away.
Wow. And how do we come up with these estimates?
It's difficult. Unfortunately, it's a topic that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention yet, at least in the U.S. And so our estimates are based off of, sometimes they use nutritional information, so caloric balances. Other times they've done some studies of, you know, digging through people's garbage cans to figure out just how much they're throwing out. So there's a variety of methods, and they're just estimates at best, but there's no doubt that there's an enormous amount of food going to waste in this country.
Because 40% sounds like a lot, and I just want to make sure that, you know, are we talking about something that's been rigorously studied? Is it something that's, you know, do you have the best guess? Is this a conservative estimate? Could it actually be more? What do you say to that?
Yeah, most people who have studied this issue think that that's actually a fairly conservative estimate. It may not even include a lot of the food that is not being harvested on farms or going to waste really early in the supply chain. So it's likely that it could even be more.
Wow. And to be clear, these figures don't include food that is thrown out for legitimate reasons, like maybe crops that have been lost to bad weather or insects or food that is spoiled. Or does it include that as well?
It does include food that gets spoiled, like the lettuce in your fridge that goes bad, is certainly part of that. It does not include things like bones and peels, and studies in other countries have focused a bit on what's avoidable and what's not avoidable. But even when you take out those, you know, things like bones and peels, it's still a a really high number.
Hmm. So there's this concept that I was reading about of this of farm to fork and just understanding the chain of food from its production to its harvesting and then delivery and consumption and in this case, waste. Why don't you paint a picture for us at each of those stages in the chain where waste can occur?
Sure. Well, starting right at the farmer, and you know, as you mentioned, there are weather and pest issues, but we also have a lot of crops that never even get harvested because they don't fit the cosmetic standards that are imposed later in the supply chain. So,
cosmetic standards. What does that mean?
So you'll notice when you go into a grocery store, you have a lot of perfectly red and perfectly round, perfectly beautiful apples. They don't all grow that way on the tree. And so when you, you know, look further up in the supply chain, you go back to the farm, if they know those apples aren't going to sell, they don't even bother picking them. So that, you know, that's where it starts and it follows through. It's relatively efficient as you go through transport and distribution as compared with the later part of the supply chain. I mean, the biggest part of the problem are really consumers and restaurants and food service.
And how do they contribute?
Well, if you think about your fridge, if everyone closes their eyes for a minute and thinks about your fridge,
I'm going to ask our listeners to go to the fridge right now.
There you go.
Open the door and then Dana is going to shame us all here. Go ahead, Dana.
Well, I mean, similar to energy, I don't think anyone could be 100% efficient in their food usage, but we are all contributing to the problem, and when we over-prepare food, the pasta you cook too much of, the party you threw, and you know, there were 8 plates left over, and the lettuce that's going bad in the fridge. That's a significant portion of the problem. Restaurants, also, there's a lot of waste that's going on in the back of the house before you ever see that plate. And then, of course, with huge portions these days, there's quite a bit left on the plate often as well.
And people not necessarily taking it home with them.
Mm-hmm. One other real cause is that people don't understand use-by dates. And so a lot of people think that use-by dates are actually federally regulated and indicate safety, but that's not the case. Those use-by dates, not to be confused with the sell-by dates, but any of those dates are not federally regulated, and they don't indicate safety. They're actually manufacturer suggestions for peak quality. And many foods can be safely, you know, consumed later on.
Beyond that use-by date. And what's the distinction that you make between use-by dates and sell-by dates?
If you look at many products, you'll actually see both dates on them. Sell-by is something the store, you know, that's a date for the store to use. And they typically do not sell food after the sell-by date.
Is there some regulation that makes them have to take it off the shelves?
I don't believe so. Maybe Sue could answer that question.
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that either.
I don't believe there is. I believe even the sell-by dates are suggestions for quality and how much shelf life a product has left.
Because I'll disclose, you know, I use the sniff test to decide when my milk has gone bad. I don't necessarily look at what's on the sell-by or use-by date.
You're my guy.
just to kind of recap there, the waste is occurring both at the farm level when it's unharvested because farmers think it's never going to fly off the shelves in the market because there's an aesthetic problem with the food. Before we move off the farmers for a second, is there any reason why farmers would just let food rot because for whatever reason it's not worth picking for other reasons? Yeah, Sue.
I can address that. There are a number of reasons that food might not even make it out of the field or the orchard. One of those Dana mentioned earlier is if there's product that isn't cosmetically acceptable, over, underweight, misshapen. In orchards, you might see spots on fruit. They call that limb rub. but there are other market forces at play as well. So, for example, if a farmer has a field and close to the time of harvest, something happens in that market, the bottom bottom drops out, the price is too low. A farmer at that point has to make the choice to cut his or her losses. So at that point, he or she can't pay a crew to come in and harvest that. They can't pay for the packaging materials and the transportation to get it to market. So there are a lot of complex ways that conditions can come up such that the food goes unharvested.
And do farmers just overplant to some extent?
I think that every farmer plants the fields with the expectation that all of that food is going to be usable. But again, we have to remember that every step of the process requires an investment. And so when that investment can't be recouped, like I said, sometimes people have to cut their losses.
Hmm. And to you, Aaron French, when we talk about the restaurant part of the farm-to-fork chain, what are your thoughts about what Dana said at the beginning, the waste that happens at the back of the house, the waste that happens when plates are not completely finished by consumers, by customers? What's your take on that?
Well, those are both extremely important issues, but also it's how we purchase food in the first place from those farmers. So actually, to go back a little bit, we can, as restaurateurs and as chefs, we can choose where and how we buy our food. And so one of the things we can do, actually, is to try and buy second-quality food that's not perfectly, you know, that doesn't look perfect. And it still tastes perfect. It's probably going to be cheaper for us to buy that food and prepare it for our customers. And we can produce often tastier products and more of it with better quality doing that. So if we can buy food that's more appropriate for our customers and get a better price, then we have the ability to take more care with that food to make sure that we're going to waste as little as possible. Because we go into our fridge, and our fridge in restaurants are huge. We have walk-in fridges, right? So when she says, close your eyes and think about your fridge, well, I close my eyes and think about a fridge as big as the studio or actually bigger. And so it's important to me that every box that comes into that fridge and also in my dry storage gets utilized by my customers. We need to make sure that we use every part of the shoot, every part of the leaf, every part of the animal that comes into the restaurant. And we need to make sure that what we put on the plates is what the customer wants. And we need to make sure that what they're ordering matches what they think they're going to get. And then ultimately it comes down to customer choice, right? Does the consumer understand what they really want to eat? Do they understand what's appropriate for them? What are they going to take home? Are they ordering because they actually want to eat that or because they think they should? There's so many consumer preference issues coming into this issue of how they order in restaurants. And then finally, to compound this, more and more customers are eating more and more out of the home, right? So they're going to the grocery store thinking, oh, this week I'm going to eat at home five nights a week. Well, in reality, they're not going to do that. They're going to eat at home much less. They're going to have all that food. They're not going to be eating that at home, and they're going to waste it. There's all kinds of issues I just brought up that all contribute to food waste and how it works in the home and the restaurant. And it's a whole cycle that connects around to itself.
Mm. And even though California cuisine is known for sort of resizing the amount of food on the plate, you still can get pretty sizable portions here in the Bay Area. How have we conditioned consumers to expect and restaurant goers to expect a certain amount of food, and how do you combat this notion of saying, you know, maybe you should consider eating less, or maybe this portion is actually good enough?
Right, and so it all comes down to consumer perception of value. So when someone goes out to eat, they want to make sure for their dollar amount, they're getting the good value for their food. So a couple of years ago, I had the idea, which I got from Zimmerman's Deli, famous out of Michigan, and they started to serve small portions of French fries and give extras if asked.
Like so, refills or
refills,
something?
Free refills on their French fries. So I don't have French fries, I have home fries. I'm a brunch chef. And so I said, great, that's a great thing. You know, I actually waste a lot of potatoes. I'm going to make those portions smaller and give free refills on those, and also the other sides as well. Well, what happened is that was fantastically received. It was really popular. And then the recession hit a couple of years ago. Everyone in the Bay Area is well aware of what happened. Everyone became very conscious of where every dollar went. Mm-hmm. And that shifted people's perceptions. And when they came into my restaurant, all of a sudden they were saying, oh, wait, I want more. I want bigger portions. And the customer perception of how they interact with their food and their food dollar and where it goes shifted towards, no, I really want more all the time, depending on whether they actually wanted to eat it all. Mm. And so now I feel like my role really is to try to make my food portions and my dishes that I'm offering such that they are a reasonable portion for people and that they want to eat them at the same time, you know, give the value perception. And that's a really difficult balance as a chef to make that happen.
Right. Sounds like you put a lot of thought into that. Dana, you wanted to add something there.
Well, Aaron brought up kind of the shopping experience at a grocery store, and I think that's just one part of the supply chain that we skipped over in talking about where a lot of this waste is coming from. Retailers, you know, again, estimates vary, but I've seen about 15% of all food waste attributed to retailers, maybe even up to 30, so it's unclear. But, you know, a lot of the waste that's caused by the retailers we actually bring home into our homes. So when you see things like buy one, get one free at the grocery store, I mean, that's a store trying to get rid of a lot of product that you're now going to take into your home. And so it's those value deals that get pushed along a little bit. So I think retailers have an important role to play in educating consumers and you know, trying to, not just trying to sell everything as much as they can all the time, which is economically a slightly maybe perverse incentive for them.
Right. So consumers are drawn in by the prices and say, oh, I this is a steal. I should take as much of this as I possibly can.
Right. Right. So if you know, a huge thing of yogurt at 10 cents an ounce is only good value if you actually eat it all. If you're only going to eat, you know, a third of it, it's actually a better value just to buy a few small yogurts.
Hmm. And but how would consumers actually see that? Because they may look at the absolute amount that they're having to spend on something and say, well, if I could get so much more for less, why would I want to spend more? Do they see this value argument that you're describing?
I don't think people, you know, track it back to their homes and the fact that they're throwing it out. I think, you know, the way you can see it is to see what you're really throwing away. And ask yourself as you throw your food away, you know, was this really a good value?
Mm. So I want to ask something like the Costco's of the world and other chains that do sort of wholesale retail or actually farm boxes, you know, that get shuttled around. How much are they contributing to food waste?
I don't have any numbers on that, but I do think, you know, I've had people tell me stories about splitting their Costco purchases with their neighbors. Certainly you can do that with a farm box as well. I think there are ways to store things in the freezer and store things elsewhere.
But it's also an issue of how often you choose to shop. So the big box stores and the CSA as well encourage you to shop, you know, once a week or even, you know, even less frequently. Whereas the older model was shop in small amounts every day or every other day. And if you actually do shop in small amounts every day or every other day, the fact is you're going to have less waste than if you shop in larger amounts every few weeks, because the shopping experience is created by the stores to make you buy, right? They have amazing crews of smart people all over the world figuring out how to make you buy things when you walk into the store. That's their job. Of course, that's what they do well, and some of these stores do it very, very well. So it is extremely common, well-known fact that people buy more than they think they're going to buy. They come home with this produce, and they think that they're going to utilize it, and they have the best intentions always. We're going to do this and this and this with it. The week goes by, they get busy, and it ends up in the green bin, we hope, in their compost, if we're lucky, probably in the trash a lot of the time.
Hmm. And what is it about our lifestyles that would keep us from shopping in multiple times a week as opposed to the big shop that everyone does on the weekends? Is there something that's incongruous if we're trying to get people to change their shopping habits?
Well, I feel like the big stores that are, quote, convenient for a lot of reasons do take time to shop. You end up filling up a huge crate to shop on, you know, a huge cart or a pallet or something like that of food. You can spend an hour or more easily. You don't want to do that every day. And you think, okay, well, if I do this, then I'll have a lot of food for a while.
So there's a sense of efficiency.
There's a sense of efficiency. And most people don't live in the village anymore. And by that, I mean the neighborhood where they can walk around and have access to the local grocery market, the local dairy, the local things that they used to have. So there are many people in the Bay Area that are so lucky to have those experiences in those neighborhoods. In San Francisco, the East Bay, the South Bay, there are neighborhoods where people can live that village life where that's an appropriate thing to do. Most of the country and even much of the Bay Area is not appropriate for that lifestyle the way it's organized and set up. And so that's about city planning and big picture ideas, which then trickle down and create food waste.
Hmm. And if you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Have you looked in your fridge yet? Tonight, we're discussing food waste in the Bay Area with our guest, Dana Gunders, project scientist with the NRDC, and that's the Natural Resources Defense Council. I always want to say national. I don't know why. And Sue Sigler, executive director of the California Association of Food Banks, and Aaron French, East Bay-based chef and author of the Bay Area Homegrown Cookbook. And now we open our lines to you, our listeners, to join our conversation with your questions and comments. The number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment or perhaps a picture of your fridge with the door open on our Facebook page, 415-841-4134. And let's go to our first caller, Gregory from Woodside. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I just wanted to say, you know, I've worked in a lot of different restaurants and hotels, and hotels are the worst. The amount of food that they throw away every day is just astronomical. I mean, they don't feed the staff or anything. It just goes into the garbage. But the shockingest thing was volunteering at food bank and actually a soup kitchen in San Francisco, and the amount of food that's thrown away because there's so many people that they can't customize each, you know, tray, and people who don't like bread, the bread gets thrown away. People who don't like salad, the salad goes in the garbage. They do compost it, but it's just really shocking to see how much food after each meal is thrown away.
And Gregory, have you looked in your fridge tonight while we were talking?
Oh, my fridge is spotless and everything is being eaten.
So how do you do it?
I live alone, and I just went on this crazy fast where I try not to do anything preservative, so I'm always going to the grocery store, and I just love it.
So the frequent trips thing that Aaron was talking about to the grocery store and buying in small quantities seems to be helping you?
And you know, it's super easy since I'm single, and you know, I don't have to cook for anyone else, and I'm a really easy eater, so.
All right. Well, Gregory, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Sue, I wanted to get to you there. Gregory was talking about going to soup kitchens and seeing how much food is wasted. And I just wanted to think back to your connection as the director of the California Association of Food Banks. How are food banks kind of involved in this farm-to-fork continuum that we've been describing? And how could they perhaps be part of a solution here?
Well, there's a couple of different ways that food banks are involved in diverting food from the waste stream. One of those is that many food banks will operate what they call a retail recovery or a retail pickup program. So most of the major grocers these days do have their stores linked with a local food bank where the food bank can come by and pick up what's expiring. We talked earlier about code dates on products for sell-by or use-by dates. So when the store is clearing that out of their inventory, as Dana mentioned earlier, the vast majority of that is still very usable. And so so food banks are now working with retailers to pick that up, and it provides a really important source of fresh food that's hard for food banks to get otherwise in terms of meat and dairy and eggs and products like that. As well, food banks work statewide at the California Association of Food Banks. We operate what we call the Farm to Family program. We work with growers and packers throughout California to obtain those slightly below market grade products that we were talking about earlier. So things that are misshapen, underweight, overweight, don't stack neatly and perfectly with all the other fruit in the grocery store. And
underweight and overweight food. How we have anthropomorphized our food. Go ahead.
It's true. And And last year we provided 120 million pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables to food banks around California who always distribute that product for free to people in need. And so in addition to recovering some of that surely would have been diverted into the waste stream, it's also an important source of fresh fruit for people in need.
Hmm. And Aaron, you wanted to say something to Gregory's points there.
I did, and the caller brought up the issue of hotels wasting lots of food, and I think one of the issues with hotel menus is that they're just extremely diverse. They want to appeal to every customer of the hotel from all over the world, and so one of the issues that occurred is that we're used to in America having every kind of food we want from all over the world all the time, and this means food is shipped in from all over the world and prepared in restaurants so that any customer can order any amazing thing from everywhere, and that simply is too much, right? We need to get used to, as our culture, having a little bit fewer choices, fewer types of produce from fewer places, hopefully, you know, closer to home. And those foods will be fresher. You know, they won't be have been shipped as far. They'll be more usable and more tasty. And we won't have as many options to waste if we do this.
Yes, Sue.
I think that points to another important point. You know, there's nothing simple about looking at food and food waste. One of the other issues is cultural appropriateness. Back to the caller's point about seeing people throw away maybe something that was on their tray. Well, it's a wonderful thing and a very needed service to have soup kitchens. But if you go in there and the food is unfamiliar to you or not appropriate for your diet for some other reason, health reason or otherwise, that those folks are in a place where they don't have a choice to go into the grocery store and select what they're going to eat. It's also something that comes up in food banks, particularly when you're looking at providing food relief in a disaster situation or other kinds of emergencies, that taking care to make sure that those things are culturally appropriate.
And usable, right? We did a show on food insecurity a while back, and some of the concerns of the San Francisco Food Bank is that they're not able to bring a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables to a lot of the dwellers in SROs, for example, in the Tenderloin and South Market area, because they don't have cooking facilities to prepare their meals. So they have to bring the higher density, less nutrient-rich foods. But so just to dovetail with a previous conversation we've had here.
And when we also think about the cultural diversity, even in small areas like our cities, that there's a lot of different cuisines, there's a lot of different palates in those areas. So, for example, we might get a donation of a truckload of potatoes. Well, we're probably not going to take that to a predominantly Asian neighborhood, because folks there are going to tell us, no, we consume starch in the form of rice. And so that's just one example. There are a myriad of them.
Mm-hmm. And Dana, did you want to add something? I noticed you nodding your head or shaking your head in disbelief there.
Well, I just wanted to point out the great amount of resources that are going to waste every time that something gets thrown away, be it at a hotel, restaurant, or in your own fridge. Agriculture uses 70% of all the water in this country, 60 times as much land as urban and suburban uses combined. It's the largest user of fertilizers and pesticides, and we could go on about all the resources that go into growing the food. And then when you consider what it takes to transport it and keep it cold through transport for fresh items, it's an enormous amount when you throw that away.
And you've set up the second half of our program perfectly. And we're going to take a break now so that we can ask your support for KLW. So this is Joseph Pache again, co-host of City Visions, and I'm here to take a short break from tonight's program to ask you for your support for City Visions and KALW. Take a moment right now to do that. It's simple. Just call or click to show your support. 1-800-525-9917. Again, 1-800-525-9917. Or go to our website, kalw.org, and click on the Donate Now button. As you may recall, City Visions just marked 20 years on the air, and KLW just celebrated its 70th anniversary as the oldest FM station west of the Mississippi this past year. Where else can you find a community service like City Visions and KLW that focuses on the ideas and issues that shape life in San Francisco and across the Bay Area? And where else can you be part of our dialogue, as I'm going to get to a few callers in just a moment? In this ever-shrinking media market, City Visions and KLW are keeping community-based public radio alive and thriving. So call 1-800-525-9917 or go to our website, www.klw.org. We know you're listening, so take the time now to show your appreciation for City Visions and KALW, 1-800-525-9917, or go to our website, kalw.org, to show that you want to preserve and grow the resource that you hear day in and day out here at KLW, a resource that brings you in-depth, non-commercial, enlightening news, conversation, music, and so much more. So won't you take a moment now, 1-800-525-9917, or our website, www.klw.org, to show your support. Thank you. And while some of you are doing that, we'll go to some of our callers here. Let's go to Komal from Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Thank you for having me on the show. I just wanted to say, I've heard of Food Runners before, and we kind of based our own model similar to it. We created an organization, me and another girl on UC Berkeley campus, and it's a food waste elimination program as well. It's called Bare Abundance, and we take our excess food from, like, campus resources, so, like, the dining halls, the cafes, the restaurants, you know, the local farmers markets, everything, the gardens, and then we redistribute that to, like, low-income schools in Oakland, where we teach them with, like, the produce that we have, like, experiential learning and, like, nutrition workshops and hands-on cooking classes. So we're trying to take that food one step further and also, like, not just do a handout model, but also preserve, kind of work within our food system. And right now what we're doing, I'm partnering with schools nationwide and trying to create a food waste elimination initiative or a program on their campus so that they can do similar things. So
if there are other students out there, either locally and at Berkeley or across the Bay Area, who are interested in setting up something like this, where can they find more information?
So they can go to our website, and it's BareAbundance, BareAbundance.org, and you can contact us through that.
Great, and we'll post that on our website, cityvisionsradio.com. Thanks so much, Komal, for your call.
Thank you.
Actually, that brought up a thought in my mind, is how can food, or trying to divert food from being wasted, help in enriching our school lunch programs? Something that's come up a lot in conversations is how little schools have to work with in terms of a budget to put nutritious lunches in front of students. Is there any way any of you here can imagine bringing the attempts to divert food from being wasted to augmenting school lunch programs? Silence. That's good on the radio sometimes.
I think it's Joseph, because you've hit on an incredibly complex issue. I think that, you know, when we talk about, you know, the food system and the issue of food waste as being incredibly complex, and if we attribute, say, you know, an enormous percentage of the food waste comes about because of food spoilage, well, then obviously that's not appropriate to take someplace else and consume. So the question becomes then, can we intervene prior to that or not? And we also know that a huge percentage comes out of household food waste. So I don't think schools would welcome everybody bringing what's turning in their refrigerator into the school each day. And then beyond that, the planning that goes on and having to meet nutritional standards and guidelines, et cetera, et cetera. So while I think it's a very thoughtful question,
it's not that simple.
I think you got silenced because there is no simple answer.
Aaron?
Right. And the issue is there's lots of food waste in small amounts all over the world, and all over the U.S. in particular. It's very important. And then there's lots of need in small amounts all over. And so it's really a matter of connecting those two dots. And so, for example, what I do as well is, you know, give it food I have to my employees who give it to their church or who live by a park where there's homeless or who give it to their, you know, to their community in other ways. And so that's a small amount of food going to a small community. And so those direct connections, I think, are what needs to be increased. It's not always about big amounts of food going to big need. It's really should be also be about small amounts of food going to small need everywhere. Mm-hmm. And if that can happen again and again and again, we can solve this problem on that small scale. And then we need a medium scale solution and a larger scale solution, et cetera.
I see. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com if you'd like to join our conversation tonight here on KLW about food waste with our guests Dana Gunders, project scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, Sue Sigler, executive director of the California Association of Food Banks, and Aaron French, East Bay-based chef and author of the Bay Area Homegrown Cookbook. And in just a moment, we'll be joined by Elizabeth Boileau of Food Runners here in San Francisco. Again, the number to call to join our conversation, 415-841-4134, or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Let's go to, let's go to Dana from Oakland. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for having such an important program. I'm an entrepreneur working to address the issue of food waste here in the Bay Area. And a few things I just wanted to point out. One very important piece of information for those of us working on food recovery is the Good Samaritan Food Act, which a lot of people don't know about. It does protect food donors from liability if they're donating food with good intentions to a nonprofit and there's been no gross negligence. So that's important. Another thing I wanted to think about is, is there a way we can expand food recovery across this country? How could we do that if it were valued and actually paid for as a service, just as we pay for recycling and trash removal? Could we really start paying food recovery as a valuable service sector that's very much needed in our society?
Some great questions for us to throw around here. Thanks, Dana, so much for your call.
Thank you.
And at this point, I actually want to bring in Elizabeth Boileau from the San Francisco-based Food Runners. She's a food activist and one of the founding board members of Food Runners. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So any thoughts about the comments from the last couple of callers?
They've been great comments. What I wanted to say is that the Good Samaritan Food Donation Act was passed in 1996, and it really does remove all the doubts that people have about donating food. And it removes the liability. We always emphasize with people, if they have any questions about it, to ask us a copy of the act. We do food rescue, and we do it from bakeries. We also pick up from Laguna Honda Hospital. We pick up already prepared foods to take it to soup kitchens as well as the clinic buildings and after-school programs. So sometimes that question arises, and that's how we can best answer it. What we do is our volunteers pick up at the place where the food has been made and deliver it immediately to our recipients. And when we put out a call for volunteers, we're saying to them, an hour a week and you can help eliminate hunger here in San Francisco. And we found that food rescue has been really something that continues to grow as the idea spreads across San Francisco. We have about 250 volunteers who pick up from a number of businesses and go out to about 235 different recipients throughout the city.
And how long have you been in operation?
Since 1987.
Wow. And how do you stay in afloat?
We stay afloat via donations, and we get grants that we write for grants from private foundations. And our food donations come from Zynga and San Francisco Whole Foods, Noe Valley Bakery, Twitter. Those programs, those agencies that make and prepare food either for their employees or for the general public.
And if an organization out there wanted to become one of your benefactors, so to speak, either in money or in kind with food donations, how would they connect with you?
They can connect with us by calling 415-929-1866, or they can go to our webpage, website, foodrunners.org, and they can see us on Facebook.
Great. Well, I'm going to have you hold there, and we'll come back to you in just a few minutes. Sue, I wanted to touch base with you and hear your thoughts about Dana's earlier comment about incentivizing food recovery programs and having it be something that's there, where there's enterprise. Any thoughts about how that could work?
I hate to keep saying the same thing over, but it sounds over and over again. But it sounds complex. I think that really there. A certain amount of food waste is likely inevitable in the system, but I think and food recovery is very important. As I mentioned, food banks rely on that type of program as well. I think for the average consumer, though, really thinking about how do you reduce the amount of waste you generate is probably the most effective thing that an individual can
do. So diversion, as it were, is only a small part of the solution. And you keep telling me, Joseph, it's about not buying so much in the first place, right? go there. And so we're going to go there. So we've made the point that when there's so many needy folks in the Bay Area, it's a shame to waste food. And we've heard about some creative ways that people across the spectrum have been trying to get food to those people in need. But I want to go back to you, Dana, and let's make the environmental argument here. Let's try to get at this issue from many, many angles and to help people, motivate people to perhaps change their habits. And then we're going to end the program with hearing tips for consumers about how they can reduce and use appropriately what they do buy. Tell us about the environmental impact of the food waste that we've been talking about tonight.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, you know, food and agriculture use up an enormous amount of the resources in the U.S. And when you consider the staggering amount of resources that are used, throwing 40% of those away is quite a significant amount.
Do you have ways of quantifying, like, how much water is being wasted, how much fuel, how much, I don't know, pesticide,
sure,
or whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, they're all, of course, back of the envelope, but, you know, approximately 25% of all the fresh water consumed in the U.S. is going to grow food that never gets eaten. 4% of oil consumption and, you know, somewhere between $90 and $160 billion, depending on how you count it, something like $750 million just to dispose of that waste. And then once that waste goes to a landfill, which doesn't happen as much here in the Bay Area, but does happen quite a bit still in the rest of the country, you're talking about hundreds of tons of methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. And so, you know, energy, greenhouse gases, water use, fertilizers, pesticide toxicity, all going to food that's just not getting eaten. I think if there's, you know, I mean, if you have to focus on one, to look in your fridge and focus on one type of food, look at your meat drawer. Think about how much meat you're consuming. It's, you know, meat consumes so many resources, and every time you throw out half a burger, the amount of water and chemicals that's getting thrown out with that is obscene.
So it could really almost erase any other efforts that people are putting a lot of energy into in terms of trying to be green if they are wasting this much food.
Absolutely. You know, I've read the statistic that 2,400 liters of water, don't make me do the math to get that into gallons, something like 500 gallons, goes into one hamburger. So if you think about half of that hamburger that you're tossing out, you know, that's a long shower.
Wow.
I did a little back of the envelope calculation about how much how much got tossed away with our Thanksgiving turkey. Mm. And in the across the U.S., all the turkey that got throughout, it was about 1 million tons of carbon dioxide, 95 billion gallons of water, and $275 million.
So are omnivores and carnivores more of a culprit here, or do vegans and vegetarians commit the same amount of food waste? Or do you not know?
I think everyone commits food waste. I think vegans and vegetarians, it probably has a slightly smaller footprint, or significantly smaller footprint. I think, you know, for those of us who are trying to do well by the earth via our diets, that looking at the amount of stuff we're throwing away is a great first step, and it doesn't involve the sacrifice. You know, before you go vegetarian, and which you may also want to do, I don't want to discourage that.
For different reasons.
Just try to use everything up. That's going to be a huge first step to reducing your environmental footprint.
415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or post a comment on our Facebook page to join our conversation tonight about food waste in the Bay Area with our guests Dana Gunders, project scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, Sue Sigler, executive director of the California Association of Food Banks, Aaron French, East Bay-based chef and author of Bay Area Homegrown Cookbook, and Elizabeth Boylo of the San Francisco-based Food Runners. 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Yes, Aaron.
And so this show obviously is specifically about food waste, but the other piece of that picture is the packaging of the food, right? So when you talk about the environmental impact of our food, you cannot forget how that food is packaged and how it's been packaged over its entire chain from the farm to when you got that food, because packaging, unfortunately, has a far greater environmental impact in terms of the emissions that are used to create that packaging and also the water used than the actual food itself. And so going back to the vegans or the vegetarians, if they're eating highly processed foods with lots of packaging and not using that food and throwing away the packaging, then that could be worse or better depending on how you look at that equation. It's very, very complex, and I think we need to just let's use up everything that we buy and let's buy in a way that's aware of how we're doing that.
Are there any initiatives to relook at packaging like there were, I don't know how many decades ago now, when we changed the way we packaged CDs, for example? Remember those? That became a big shift. Any thoughts on that, Dana?
Sure. There certainly are many initiatives at the kind of industry level looking at packaging and packaging redesign. It's a huge topic. It's a hot topic. I'm not sure I'd agree with Aaron that packaging is always the biggest life cycle impact. I think when you talk to experts, you'll see there's some debate around that. And of course, it depends on which packaging you're talking about. But, you know, I've had one expert say to me, you'd do better to buy those six-pack single-serving yogurts instead of one big one, because you'll waste, you know, if you waste less that way, right, that the resources going into that yogurt are actually far more than the packaging. So
okay. So jumping off of our Facebook page and onto our phone is Buka. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I love your program tonight. It's excellent.
Great. So what's your comment or question for our guests?
Well, I certainly agree with a lot of what's been said about lowering consumption and trying to be more efficient in buying habits and being really conscientious or more conscientious about waste. And I'm calling because there's evidence to show that potentially individuals and restaurants and health facilities can do a lot in helping our farmers by generating, you know, worm castings. And I'm biased because I teach people how to compost their kitchen scraps that do go bad, the funky, smelly variety of non-aesthetically pleasing, kitchen waste. So, you know, they can generate garden fertilizer, and it's even valuable for folks who don't garden.
So you mean composting with worms?
Composting on a small scale basis. Alameda County across the bay subsidizes worm bins, and I understand that San Francisco used to have a worm composting subsidy in place, but currently the plastic, you know, variety of worm composting bins are pretty price prohibitive. I mean, it's a barrier to entry, you could say. It's $100 to $150 to get a brand new worm bin, but this could
dramatically shift where we put our waste and also help local gardens, community gardens at the same time.
Great. And how can people find out more about this?
Well, you would just Google, you know, red worm composting or vermicomposting, but I teach with kitchengardensf.org and Hayes Valley Farm and a variety of other places. I just think it's really in line with what Gavin Newsom passed a few years ago, which is to, you know, mandate that we separate our blue bin trash. I think mandating that we separate our green bin could help recology and help our gardeners.
Very good. Thanks so much for your call, Buca.
Thank you.
And let's go next to John from San Francisco. Welcome to our program. And turn down your radio, John.
Yeah, no, my radio is off. Thanks.
Okay. Still hearing the echo.
Sorry, I'm in my car getting the sound from the phone out through the... Anyway, can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, terrific. What role does companies like Monsanto and Arthur Daniel Mitchell, the huge agribusinesses that are trying to increase their market share by basically encouraging us to consume larger portions, the whole supersize era that we live in, do you think that if we looked at it like, hey, getting that extra large size of fries is actually putting money in the big agribusiness's pocket, do you think that might help, or am I off base there?
I'm going to have you take your answer off the air. Thanks so much, John, for your call. So, data.
Wow, there's a lot to that question. I think, you know, the Monsantos of the world are not directly sort of advocating for us to be eating fast food. I mean, certainly there's a whole conversation to be had around subsidies and things that are leading to cheap fast food. I'd like to just give fast food actually a kind mention here, because I think one thing they do is offer flexible portioning. And as far as restaurants go, I mean, you can go into McDonald's and get a small 69-cent hamburger, or you can get a quadruple burger. And if you're not that hungry, you know, the flexible, now what's in that
is a different story.
But those portions, I think, you know, the impact that companies such as Monsanto are having is a little more abstract and global. You're hearing a lot of debate these days about how are we going to feed the world in 2050. You hear that question all over. The Economist just did a special report on it. There's going to be 9 billion people. How will we feed them? And very quickly, that conversation is going directly towards the answer, which is grow more food on the same land. The UN predicts we're going to need 70% more food by 2050. If we don't want to cut down rainforests, we clearly have to grow more food on the same land. I think it would be great if instead of directing resources only to that, we direct more resources to the 40 to 50% of food we're already growing that's not getting eaten right now. And I think, you know, we haven't even begun to really invest technology in the complexity of solving this issue. Mm-hmm. And I think if we were to put some of the millions and millions that are going into growing more food on the same land, which may or may not be sustainable, we might find some solutions to that.
And to
question.
Bring it back to that refrigerator, the one that's in everyone's home, if you're listening at home, help us, Dana, as we wrap up our program tonight, go through some easy tips, quick tips for consumers on how they can reduce their food waste pretty quickly.
Sure thing. And I'm sure lots of listeners could call in and give us some tips. But I think some good steps to start off with are really, as we've been talking about, planning your meals, using shopping lists, buying from bulk bins only what you need, and avoiding impulse buys at the grocery store when you're seeing all those great offers that may wind up in your garbage can the next week. Freezers are a great tool. It's amazing the amount of food that you can actually freeze and will be okay when you defrost it. So before you go on vacation, throw a bunch of things in the freezer, experiment with that. There's an excellent website called Love Food, Hate Waste, with recipes from chefs on things you can use, and lots of storage tips. And then I like to tell people to buy funny fruit. And so, you know, farmers markets, you can find a lot of fruit in funny shapes and sizes that you don't see at the grocery store. Buy that funny fruit wherever you can, because it's really using more of the fresh, nutritious resources we have in this country.
And I'm just following along with you because there's a really great food facts digest here that goes over many of these tips that you didn't also mention: donating your food, composting, eating those leftovers as well. Basically, just being more mindful about how much you buy and how you use it, and just sort of being vigilant about what's in your refrigerator. We had a caller actually that unfortunately left us here that was going to talk about labeling food in some way that kind of reminds you what's about to go bad, you know, soon, so that you can sort of get in, get something in a queue for yourself. So some good tips there. So Aaron, in closing, what kind of tips to consumers when they are restaurant goers?
Well, also at home, though, people need to just take some time and learn how to use their kitchen. How do you use knife skills? How do you use your pans? What can you do with leftovers in a pan and add some more things to make them fresh and tasty? So there are lots of things you can do in your home with your kitchen. Learn to cook. Do all the things you can do with all the resources on the web and in books to use everything we have in our modern kitchen. And at restaurants, really just think about what you really want. What you really want to eat, not what you think you should eat, and order what you think you're going to eat.
All right. We have 2 minutes left. A quick word from you, Sue, about how people should be trying to connect with food banks.
Well, please always support your local food bank. And one of the things that so in terms of what you might have personally that could be of use, one of the other things we didn't talk about is a lot of people have a lot of backyard fruit trees and that maybe never get harvested or provide far more than you can. It's a wonderful thing to trade with your neighbors. Your local food bank would also really welcome that.
And so there's the San Francisco Food Bank, and we talked about Front Runners, and I'm sorry, we're almost out of time here. Dana, you have a plug for something that's very timely here. Go ahead.
Yes. Tomorrow evening, if this topic is of interest to you, there will be a screening of the movie Dive, which dives into this topic more from the perspective of a dumpster diver. And that event is going to be at the Rally Pad at 144 2nd Street in San Francisco at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow night.
Very good. So we have to stop here for this evening. Thanks to all of my guests, Dana Gunders with the Natural Resources Defense Counselor, Sue Sigler with the California Association of Food Banks, Aaron French, East Bay chef and author of Bay Area Homegrown Cookbook, and Elizabeth Boileau of Front Runners. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. City Vision's senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Friess manages our website. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer next Monday as we discuss the consumer movement to transfer money to credit unions. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, have a great week, and don't forget to support KLW.